Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, I need a little help for a fellow streetwalker. On May 10th, 1996, Leon Lorales was murdered outside of Brownwood, Texas, and the case has never been solved. The investigation so far has only resulted in dead ends and bad leads, leading his family and friends struggling with the lack of information. Leon's niece and fellow streetwalker, Arlene Harbison, has set up a GoFundMe to help finance the hiring of a private investigator to help the family get some answers. The GoFundMe will also be used to create a memorial in Brownwood to bring attention to his case and ensure he is not forgotten. If you're a listener, you're a streetwalker. If you're a guest, you're a streetwalker. If you're a friend of the show, you're a streetwalker. And I like to think that the streetwalkers are a tight-knit community willing to help each other out. Let's help Arlene Harbison and her family get the answers they need and help close this awful, awful period in their lives. Join me in donating to the Justice for Leon Lorales Fund today. You can go to GoFundMe.com and search Leon Lorales, Laurelles. Thanks, folks.
Hey, all you cool cats and kittens. It's Carol Baskin, and you are listening to Fascination Street.
I believe that everybody has a story, and I'm fascinated to hear them. So come with me as we take a walk down Fascination Street. Welcome back, streetwalkers. This episode is with comedian Liz Mealy. Liz is a stand-up comedian for over 20 years. She started when she was 16 years old, if you can believe that. And she is going gangbusters. She has a podcast out called Two Non-Doctors. They're currently on hiatus right now, but there's a whole catalog to get caught up on. She has a book out right now called Why Cats Are Assholes. And she has four stand-up specials, three of which are free on YouTube, the most recent one being The Ghost of Academic Future. And in this episode, we talk about everything from why she got into comedy, how in the hell she got to be mentored by George Carlin, of all people. We talk about the genesis of one of her most viral video jokes. We talk a lot about coping. She tells us why she thinks marriage is dumb. Some pretty good reasons there. We talk about how her 2020 comedy tour went. And she tells us why she hates TikTok. Everybody, go check out her website, LizMealy.com. That's where the book is. That's where all of her social media tags are. The one stand-up special that's not currently free on YouTube, you can actually stream it from her website, LizMealy.com. And this is my conversation with comedian and now author, Liz Mealy.
You talk to me, yeah.
Welcome to Fascination Street Podcast, Liz Mealy. How are you doing today, Liz?
I'm good. How are you?
I cannot complain. Ladies and gentlemen, Liz Mealy is one of the most, I'm going to say, prolific and hilarious comedians that you're going to find today everywhere you look. She's on YouTube. She has a podcast, which I think might be on hiatus.
Yeah.
Her newest YouTube special is called The Ghost of Academic Future. She even has a book called Why Cats Are Assholes. I have theories. We'll get into that later. Hopefully you can help me understand my own theories about why cats are assholes. I like to start with where people were born and raised. It kind of helps us get to understand how they turned into who they are. So where were you born and raised? Where'd you grow up?
I was technically born in Columbus, Ohio, but we moved when I was one. So I'm mostly a Jersey girl. I would say Columbus has had no effect on me, and every bad thing about me spawned from New Jersey.
And all the good things, too.
Yeah, no, I would like to think that some of my charm is from there, but, you know, that's out for debate.
Have you been to Columbus, Ohio as an adult?
I haven't. And my best friend, who I did the podcast with, Maria Shahada, is from there. So many times we tried to put like tours together, or like I wanted to go visit her and her family, and like all these things just always fell through. That's where my parents went to college. I've gotten close, but I actually have not been back to where I was born.
Okay. So call up Maria, make it an appointment that you're going to stay there for like a whole weekend, because I think it's like an hour outside of Columbus is a small town called Chillicothe, Ohio. Have you ever heard of this town?
No.
This is going to blow you away.
I'm ready.
Are you familiar with the American Indian chief Tecumseh?
Mm-mm.
Okay, so he is the Native American chief who tried to unite all of the tribes against the encroaching white man.
Good. Good for him.
He's a huge figure in that he was the uniter of all the tribes for a common goal against a common foe. Chillicothe, Ohio, which I said is like an hour outside of Columbus, they have been doing this thing for like 48 years on this giant mountain. It's called Sugarloaf Mountain. They have an amphitheater that holds like 1,000 people or something insane like that. And they do this live action performance of the life of this guy, Tecumseh. It's called Tecumseh with an exclamation point. It is one of the most amazing shows I've ever seen. I live in San Antonio, Texas, and up until COVID, we would fly there at least once every summer for like 3 years in a row just to go see this thing and to see our friends who live there. But there's like 12 horses in this thing. There's like cannon fire and gunfire. There's people falling off cliffs into water. It is amazing. I highly recommend it.
That's awesome.
It is so dope. So make an appointment with Maria and go get that done, because you will thank me. I'll be waiting for a letter.
How often do they do that show?
They do it every day for like the entire like summer and fall. They do like, I don't know, 120 performances or something like that.
Wow. Incredible.
Maybe it's just every weekend, but they do it a lot.
I hope those horses are a part of a union. That sounds like a lot of work.
I think all of the actors are part of a union, especially the horses.
I hope so. I hope they are making more money than all those ones that are in like the Kentucky Derby and stuff.
Well, nobody makes more money, not even the people of the horses in the Kentucky Derby. So let's just
okay.
So that was a little side tangent I did not expect to go on, because we're here to talk about you, not about all the fun things you're going to do in Columbus with Maria. I think I heard you say once that you're 100% Italian.
I mean, that's what I was told, but it's been interesting since, you know, like the 23andMe's and all that stuff came out. So I've never done it. I don't really care. But my aunt, my dad's sister, did it. And when she did it, like, let's say 5 years ago, it said 97% Italian. And we're like, yeah, of course. But the way all those things work is the more people that do it, the more fact, because like they're just comparing you to what they have as a base of people that have already sent in blood and whatever they send. I don't know, spit, blood, whatever you give them, hair, whatever. I'm assuming it's like voodoo. I don't really understand science. Anyway, you send your stuff and you're compared to what they already have as a base. But as more people send it in, cousins, distant cousins, whatever, you start to get more accurate information. So my aunt was making me laugh because she goes, we started out 97% Italian. And then over the years, we just keep getting less and less Italian. We're like at 66% Italian. And then she said it came back that we were 10% Iranian, which really makes a lot of sense because I get Middle Eastern all the time. Maria is Middle Eastern. She's Egyptian. And I told her, I was like, hey, I think I might be like 5% Middle Eastern. And she goes, I knew it. I knew you were my sister. I knew it. And I go, I think it's Iranian though. She goes, shut up. You're Egyptian. I knew it. Like, it makes sense that there would be some Middle Eastern. Cause like, I get everything, to be honest. I get Puerto Rican. I get Middle Eastern. I get half black, half white. I just have a very ethnically ambiguous face. But what I find, I guess, just like a little fascinating is that somebody told me, I think a fan, she goes, where's your family from in Italy? And I go, well, I was always told like Sicily and Naples. And she goes, do you know more people, almost everybody says Naples, but actually most Italian Americans aren't from Naples. It was just the port that everybody left at. And like, of course, none of these people care. So they'd be like, where'd you come from? You would say Naples, but you're not actually from Naples. That's just the port you left out of. So who knows where we're from?
That makes sense. I get that all the time. People are always saying, I look like I'm American or Canadian or white or white. It's just different shades of white.
I feel you, sister.
I get it. I know a woman who, for her entire life, she was under the impression, her entire family was under the impression that they were like 100% Italian. And then this lady's sister did that 23andMe, and it turns out they're like 0.5% Italian.
Wow. What are they really?
They're everything.
Yeah.
They're Irish. They're British. Like, they're Puerto Rican. They're everything except Italian. Okay, so you started in stand-up comedy. I'm going to say you were still in diapers. You were 16 when you start. You did your first stand-up show.
Yeah.
What? Why comedy? What about the comedy world made this tiny little girl go, you know what I'm going to do? That.
I just loved it. I mean, I always liked laughing and making people laugh and everything that had to do with humor. But I think in the beginning, you watch like SNL and you watch funny movies. And like, I grew up when like Sandra Bullock was, you know, doing pratfalls and in rom-coms and was like kind of that quintessential, charming, funny lady. And I thought I wanted to be her. And then I discovered stand-up when I was like 13, 14, and it all just kind of clicked. I was like, because I didn't really ever wanted to act. I didn't really care about acting. It just seemed like the only way to be funny. And then when I discovered stand-up, I was like, oh, I get all the attention. This is great. Like, I was like, I want that. So I loved it. I was obsessed with it. You know, I bought every album. I listened and watched every special. It all made life worth living and made everything better. And it became my way of connecting with people and making my family laugh, making my friends laugh, making me feel less alone. You know, I was under the impression when I discovered it, you got to be like 25. You know, you just don't know. This is before podcasts and all these like memoirs and books and stuff. But there wasn't really much when I started or when I got into it at 13, 14. So like Margaret Cho had a book and she had started at 15. Chris Rock had started at 17. Dave Chappelle started at 14. A couple other people have started at 18. And I started to get the impression that I didn't have to wait until I was 25. And that while it might be different as a teenager to start, that I could do it. And so when I was 14, I started writing jokes. When I was 15, I started writing to comedians and doing research about the best way for me to get up, like what open mics, so should I go to New York City? Should I do something in Jersey? And I just started collecting information. And 16 is when I really kind of got the gumption and put myself out there.
I'm glad that you brought up writing letters. I'm going to get back to your early years in a second, but this is a sentence I never thought I would say. Tell me about your mentoring relationship with George Carlin.
It's still surreal. And I've talked about it more recently because of the George Carlin documentary and talking to Michael Bonifiglio and Judd Apatow, who produced that, and letting them know, like, I used to write him letters and he gave me tickets to shows and I met with him and, you know, we emailed and he was such a supportive person. Him being a legend and in his 70s and me being a teenager that literally wrote a letter that was like, hey, I want to do this and you're one of my favorites. Do you have any advice? And he called. So basically when I was 15, I came out to my parents that I wanted to do stand-up, like the way you would come out being gay. My parents are both veterinarians. I've always been like a crazy cat lady. My cat is being oddly very good right now. He's asleep, but usually he's just walking over here and trying to like play with my hair. So I thought I was going to be a veterinarian like my parents. They were kind of counting on it. And then I discovered stand-up and I was like, oh yeah, I forgot I'm dumb and I hate school. Why would I do that? So I came to my parents and I told them I wanted to do stand-up and they were oddly supportive.
Because they didn't want to have to pay for veterinary school. That's why.
I mean, they still forced me to go to college, even though I was half-heartedly in it. But they were oddly supportive. And my dad, who, you know, very much, both my parents are very self-made people, was like, well, if this is what you want to do, you should ask the people that are already doing it. What's the best way to go about it? You know, this is in 2000. I spent every day after school on the shared computer that my whole family had. I would rush home so I could be the first one that got the computer. And I would look up emails, addresses, whatever, of like every comedian that I loved. The address I found for Carlin turned out to be his office. He went to an office every day in Santa Monica. I believe it was Santa Monica. I can't remember. But he would go to this office and I had just sent a letter. And my dad told me to write it like a business letter. So it was like my name, my address, my email, and my phone number. And then it was like, "Dear Mr. Carlin, I'm a fan. I like what you do. I'm 15. I want to start doing stand-up, but I don't even know where to start. Any thoughts would be helpful." You know what I mean? Like, and I wrote that similar email and or letter to most people. Two people got back to me. I sent out like 40 emails and letters. Judd Apatow actually got back to me, which was funny to tell him over 20 years later when I talked to him about this documentary. He told me to stay in school. I literally read it and I was like, no. I was like, I hate school. I don't want to do this. But it was very nice. And then George Carlin called me because my number was on there. And I had like a 10-minute conversation where he basically didn't tell me anything all that mind-blowing. It was about writing and getting up as much as possible and just about getting better and how to get better. But he not only basically was like, go do it, don't wait, but also was very kind about being like, you have my address, you can write to me anytime. So I wrote to him again, basically being like, I've been doing this, and he would give me suggestions. I wrote to him after I started. He was super encouraging. I got written up in the New Yorker magazine when I was 18. I was profiled. I sent him the magazine. He called me up to be like, thanks for sending it. I loved it. Had questions, was just super kind, sent me free tickets. Years later, I was 19. So I was like 4 years in and I couldn't figure out how to do longer sets. Like I was struggling to put like a longer set together and I had questions. So he was coming to town and we met in the lobby of his hotel and he busted out his computer and kind of showed me how he organized his jokes and how he memorized longer things and more like kind of nitty gritty tactile things that are like the fun stuff, but more the boring, like how you build. From then on, I had his phone number and his email. So I'd email and keep him in the loop. Last time I emailed him, I had filmed my first TV spot for Comedy Central. It was coming out in June. And I emailed him to be like, hey, it comes out in 2 days. He's like, can't wait to watch it. And then he died 2 days later because he was in the hospital.
So he died on the same day that your special came out? I mean, your
comedy. I believe so.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That is rough.
And I'm still upset about it.
Well, you should be. It sounded like before you even met him, he had a profound impact on your entire life and your future. And then after you met him, like he just did more of the same. I think that's really cool.
I mean, it's funny because that was one of the reasons I reached out to Judd and Michael about the documentary. It was like everybody knows what a legend he is. Everybody knows how prolific and inspirational and what he did for comedy and speaking out for like the little guy. But I think we often don't talk about, I mean, I don't say we often don't, but like, you know how like Keanu Reeves being like this overly kind person is almost like a meme now? Like, I don't know if you've seen like—
Not almost. It is a meme.
Yeah, it is. Like they're like when you see something, you don't even know if it's true anymore because he has done such outlandishly over the top kind things that you're like, I don't know, maybe he rescued a penguin and gave it to everybody on a flight. Like that doesn't seem out of the ordinary with him.
I think Shaq is the same way. He's turning into that same thing.
That's awesome though. Like I really think kindness should be like that. And I think he had not only a profound impact on my work ethic and my comedic path, but he had a profound impact as I become more successful myself about how I help people, in what capacity I help people, and the excuses people make about not having time to help others, and how just a little bit of help can actually change the course of somebody's life. And I was raised to be a kind person. I've always liked being kind, but I think he really shaped how to be kind while successful and how to be kind while juggling a lot, because it's never going to get slower or easier. So how do you carve out time to help others and not forget that many people helped you get where you are?
I think that anybody who loves cats as much as you was not raised to be a terrible person, except maybe Dr. Evil.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that heartwarming story about George Carlin. I think he was the bee's knees. My parents had 8-track tapes of his shows, of his albums growing up. And so I got to hear all that crazy stuff and it always made me laugh.
Hey, Streetwalkers. Here's a word from our sponsors.
So I ran into previous guest of this show, Chris Gronkowski, the other day, and it went a little something like this.
Hey, Steve.
Hey, Chris. Hey, you know what sucks? When I get done with my workout at the gym, my protein shake's not cold anymore, man. It's room temperature.
Weird. I haven't run into you at the gym lately.
Busted. Okay, truth be told, I don't work out. But I do get thirsty after a long day of podcasting. I just can't seem to keep my cocktails cold.
You should use an ice shaker.
What's an ice shaker?
The ice shaker is a double-walled, vacuum-insulated, stainless steel shaker bottle with a patented twist and agitator that breaks up the protein powders.
So you're saying I should switch to an ice shaker, take out the agitator so I can fit more ice in the cup and it'll stay cold longer?
Steve, you don't need more ice. The ice shaker is third-party tested and verified to keep your drink cold for 30-plus hours.
Chris, you're a genius. I'll still remove the patented screw and agitator and just add more booze.
I guess technically you could, but if you actually use the ice shaker as a protein drink cup, the agitator breaks up the powder and doesn't bounce around like you're shaking a paint can.
Why are we still talking? Let's party.
Grog style!
That's right, streetwalkers. Ice shaker is made from kitchen-grade stainless steel so it doesn't smell all funky after you use it a couple of times like those cheap plastic ones. When I'm out and about doing interviews or partying Gronk style, I use the Fascination Street Podcast Edition 26-ounce Flex Ice Shaker Cup, and it keeps my drink cold until the sun comes up. You saw Ice Shaker on Shark Tank. All five sharks made an offer with Mark Cuban and Alex Rodriguez closing the deal. Now you can get a deal too. Order your own 26-ounce Flex Cup right now at iceshaker.com and use the promo code FSP for $5 off your first order. Once again, that's iceshaker.com, promo code FSP, as in Fascination Street Pod, for $5 off your first order. That's iceshaker.com, promo code FSP.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Let's get back into it.
Okay, we're going to get into the nitty gritty here. When you were 14, you did liquid ecstasy, pill ecstasy, smoked a cigarette and a beer all the same night, and it was all for the first time? What?
I was a teenager. I lived in Jersey. It's funny because I ended up becoming like a pretty big pothead, but once I started doing stand-up, I kind of stopped doing all that stuff. But it was like, I was sad. I felt lost. I didn't feel any different than most teenagers. And that's what my friends were doing. And I was like, oh, okay. And then as I got more into comedy, as I became more focused on pursuing something as opposed to just not being sad all the time, I didn't feel like I needed it anymore. I could tell that I was self-medicating most of the alcohol and drug use that I did as a teenager.
And why do you think you needed to do that? You've said in many, many interviews how awesome your parents are and all your brothers and sisters. You guys all have a great relationship. Why do you think you needed to self-medicate? Feel free to say it's none of my business, by the way.
No, I mean, I can admit that my parents are incredible people and wonderful people, and my siblings are incredible people and wonderful people, and also say that it was a shitty childhood at the same time. I don't blame my parents. I don't think I could have done a better job with the lack of support and the overwhelming nature of everything they were doing, but it was a overwhelming abusive household. And I was given a responsibility of an adult as a kid. I mean, I babysat my brothers as young as 9. I was responsible for my brothers and helped my mom out constantly. Like, I was telling somebody at brunch the other day that, like, I remember going to college and doing my laundry and not realizing that laundry only takes an hour because it would take all day. All day. It was 7 people's clothes and you had to choose. You could either watch a kid or you could do laundry. And those were the only ways you could watch TV. So like, I was like, I would literally be like, I got Sam. And then I would put Sam in like the crux of my arm. And because Sam was so easy, they'd be like, you also have to do laundry. So it's like, you're watching Sam and you're doing laundry, but I got to watch MTV. It was very exciting. I still struggle with feeling like I don't have to take everything on because that was my entire childhood, is that I was responsible for myself and other people. And I was supposed to help my parents as if I was a third parent.
Wow. Well, I think you came through it all right.
Yeah.
Nothing that a nice solid decade of therapy and an occasional pop-in visit doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
When you discovered stand-up comedy, it sort of diverted your attention from becoming an actress because you were like, hey, I get all the attention. It's just me up there. But then did that change or how did it affect you when you realized, yeah, I get all the attention, but I'm going to make like $9?
I read enough books and I was such a nerd about comedy and understanding it that I knew that it wasn't a lot of money. I knew that it was going to take an exceptional amount of time to get where I wanted to go if this became my full-time job. And I understood that even if I got to where I wanted to be, it might not be lucrative. And that didn't bother me. I mean, what's the alternative? You have enough money, but you don't like your life. Like, maybe it's the ignorance of being a child when I made this decision, but I wasn't thinking, how am I going to take care of myself? I was thinking, how do I stop being sad?
Wow. That's interesting, considering that even when you were a kid, you were having to take care of not only yourself, but other people. I find it a little interesting that it didn't translate to, you know, how am I going to take care of myself in the future? But that's rad. I love the capricious youth and, you know, for lack of a better term, youthful ignorance. I wish there was more of that.
I mean, I think that's where I feel like I had an advantage over a lot of my friends that did start in their mid-20s, late-20s, early-30s, is that I did have a little bit of a disconnect of how this is going to work. You know what I mean? Like, and I do feel like I had a little bit of a head start to kind of fuck around with it more than most people. Because like, if you're failing at something and you're 19, well, who cares? You know, I'm still in college and really nobody knows what they're doing at 19. And if I still have a temp job at 22, well, I just got out of college and everybody's trying to figure out what the real job is going to be. Like, I had a little bit of a head start of playing around and not actually know what I'm doing, as opposed to, you know, I have friends that started at 30 and everybody looks at you like, shouldn't you be getting married and having kids and have a full-time job or getting promoted or traveling the world or doing something that everybody can look at and go, oh yeah, that's what you should be doing. So I feel like anybody that looked at me and I was 19 doing something like this would be like, yeah, get it out now. It's the difference between trying your first drug as a teenager and trying your first drug at 40. People are like, the time to have done that was 20 years ago.
That makes sense. So with that in mind, and as lonely as I have to imagine it was being the only person in your teens who was trying to be a stand-up, what does it feel like when you hit a milestone or you level up or whatever in your career and there's no one around you who even understands what that means? I guess I'm asking, what is the loneliness of leveling up by yourself, if that makes sense?
I mean, I don't feel like I did level up by myself. I feel like, you know, I'm very fortunate and I've worked very hard to be a good friend and to surround myself with good friends, both in the industry and not in the industry, that I think you can easily explain to somebody. And in some things, you know, being on TV, it's not really hard to let people know that's a big deal, or channels that we all watched, or even now, like, I'm starting to perform at bigger and bigger clubs and build a fan base. And it doesn't take much for people to see the numbers that I'm getting on YouTube or on Instagram or the clubs I'm working and be like, oh, I've never been here before and this is exciting, or people are really responding to my work and this is exciting. Like, I haven't had too many people, even my parents, not be able to really understand, maybe not to the same degree the way like a comic would, but the loneliness that I have felt when I was younger isn't there anymore. I mean, between therapy and working hard on friendships and understanding, my work isn't my life anymore. My work is important to me and it's still probably number one, but my work isn't everything. And I think a lot of people spend their whole life believing their accomplishments are going to be what makes them who they are and keeps them warm at night and makes them feel less alone and makes them feel valued. And I was like that for a very long time. And it was difficult because you don't realize until you have that accomplishment that the loneliness is still there. You just kind of put it at bay for an hour or a couple hours or a week. So I think the work that I've done in therapy and I think the work that I've done in my friendships has allowed that no matter if I have an accomplishment or not, I still have this community. And whether I get what I want or I don't, I still am proud of the work that I'm putting out there. And I think that has been my biggest asset and my secret weapon as somebody that's been doing this 20 years and has become successful, but probably not the level of success that some people either strive for or believe is successful.
Do you think that those years of therapy helped you get to that place where you're not alone and you're okay with the you that is an adult now?
Absolutely. I've always been a hard worker. I've always been somebody that pushes themselves. But like I was saying, you can accomplish everything you want and you're still left with your shitty mindset and your shitty personality. And more I was getting what I wanted or being just shy of what I wanted and not feeling okay. And therapy really made me see all the wonderful things that I have currently, work in a way that made me feel more satisfied and satiated and work in a way that made me grateful for everything that I do and everything I have and the baby steps going forward. I don't know where I would be without therapy. Maybe I would be this successful. Maybe I would be more successful, but I really doubt it. Therapy allowed me to refocus on what I wanted and what was important to me, as opposed to focusing on what I need to accomplish so that I can feel loved and how destructive that mindset is. And so now, whether I accomplish my goals or just short of my goals, I can still be proud of myself and happy and stay focused in a way that's positive.
Wow. That makes sense. We're going to jump around a little bit from here on. So a few years ago, you had sort of a viral video on YouTube, I guess, that was basically about feminist sexual positions. Can you tell me, not the actual positions, but maybe the genesis of that joke and why you think that it became so popular?
Yeah, it's interesting to me because it's not really my brand of humor. It just kind of came out authentically. I never really talked about sex that much. And I never was really, not that it's all that graphic, but it's a little more explicit than I would normally talk about. I mean, I'm not even joking. I mostly tell cat jokes. And this became such a big thing. And the reason I wrote it is it came from a very authentic conversation with my little brother, which sounds a little weird. But my brother, who's now 28, was living with my sister. And I came over to visit them, and he was telling these like shitty sex position jokes. You know what I mean?
I think they were Urban Dictionary, right?
Yeah. And like some of them, it's funny because I found out after the fact that some of them were written by comedians. Like one of the ones I quote is written by Patrice O'Neill, who I was friends with, and he was a funny person, but he was never my brand. I can appreciate my coworkers and the people I meet along the way while also being like, that might just not be something I partake in. So I always enjoyed him as a person and enjoyed him on interviews and stuff, but I didn't really watch his stand-up because he wasn't that kind to women in it. And I just didn't feel good watching it. So it's even funnier that it became a street joke. And that's what my brother was telling somebody. And I listened to my brother tell this joke and it made me mad. I raised him. Like, he doesn't know what he's saying because he was like 20 at the time, but it pissed me the fuck off. And I yelled at him. And I yelled at him because I felt like almost like a parent, like I failed. Like, this joke isn't funny and you should know better because I raised you. I raised you to be a funny person. My brother's one of the funniest people you'll ever meet and one of the kindest people you'll ever meet. And then also, I was mad, and I was mad for days. And over the course of being mad at him, I realized I wasn't really mad at him. I was mad at the fact that if this is what he's hearing from the world and from our culture and from everybody, because I've heard women tell these jokes, what you're hearing is that sex is about kind of shitting on women. Like, the butt of the joke is always women. And I was like, why don't we have any that are about men? Because they're equally, it wasn't even like, let's shit on men. It was just like, fine, if you're going to shit on women, let's do it the other way around. I don't understand why women are always the butt of the joke. And I remember telling my brother this, and I remember like spitballing with him and us laughing and stuff like that. Like, it became almost healing to kind of think of this idea, why I was angry about it and what that meant for our culture. I always say my writing process is sticky thoughts. So I might have a conversation with you and it's sealed up in the conversation. You ask me a question, I answer it, and we're done. But sometimes I have a conversation or an argument or an idea or a thought or a feeling and I can't let it go. I'm just angry and I can't let it go. I'm sad and I can't let it go. I'm confused and I don't know how to fix it. I'm really happy, but I don't even understand why I'm this happy. So it's these kind of like sticky feelings and thoughts, and I try to follow them. And in following them, I find out how I really feel, where my opinion lies, how I got to that opinion, how I would fix it if I could fix it, what it means about me, how I was raised wrong, how I think shitty, whatever it is. And that's really what the birth of that joke was a conversation with my brother that made me mad about our culture.
Now, I've heard you sort of explain roughly that that's where the bit came from. Has he ever shared with you his thoughts about how him telling that, how that experience affected you? Like, I'm sure he's heard you sort of explain the same things that you just explained to me, but has he ever expressed thought? I mean, I'm sure he apologized, but has he ever expressed thoughts about how that might have affected you or anything like that?
I don't feel like he had any reason to apologize. I don't think he knew what he was doing. I know it sounds silly to say that about a 20-year-old, but he didn't. You know what I mean? I mean, he just didn't understand what he was saying. And you know, some guys don't. they're in a position of privilege where they never had to think about it from any. I did a TED talk a couple of months ago. I was just doing a set. So they basically have all these talks. And at the end of each section of sets, they have a musician or a comedian. So I do 20 minutes of jokes. And then I'm hanging out with all the speakers in the lounge afterwards. And the speaker is sitting with me and he looks at me and he goes, "Why is it that women only talk about dating?" And I go, "I'm sorry. Did I only talk about dating?" He goes, "It feels like you only talked about dating." I go, "Do you believe that men don't talk about dating?" And he goes, "Oh, I don't know. We'll call him Bob." I go, "Bob, I talked about ghosts. I talked about cats. I talked about dating. I talked about walking down the street. I talked about so many topics, but you only heard the dating stuff. So if a man was doing the exact same set I did, it's already relatable because you're a guy. You can already put yourself in that position. So if he talks about dating, is he really talking about dating or is he just talking about the male experience? So you can already put yourself in that position. But now when you see me, it's outside of it because it's a woman's perspective and you can't put yourself in that situation. Or sometimes it feels like I'm critiquing your perspective. So it becomes even more obvious that this isn't your perspective and what you would talk about. So did I talk only about dating or did I just talk about a bunch of stuff that you needed to do some work to understand my side of it and you didn't want to? Women and men talk about dating the same amount. You only feel more aware of it because it's not from your perspective. And I am tired of having to justify what I talk about. It is the same. It's just not from your perspective.
Wow. What did Bob say when you explained that to him that you didn't just talk about?
It's funny because I don't care. And it was really interesting because these are all like professionals. These people are doctors and lawyers or whatever. And I talked to this guy like he was my brother-in-law at a party and I never wanted to see him again. I could give a fuck what this guy thought of me. And you just watched all the speakers be like, "Wow." Like, because I don't give a fuck. I don't care if you have 17 degrees, you're wrong. And I'm tired of this question. And I would say that 70% of my anger and pushback was because this always happens and I'm tired of it. And I gave him a little bit too much gruff for somebody that didn't understand what he was asking. But also, you're a professional. You are somebody that is out there giving people legal advice or whatever the hell he does. And you don't even know that in taking in everything, you aren't looking at it from a diverse level of perspectives. And so I think for me, as a female comic, I am constantly criticized from this reference point. I don't care if you don't relate to me. My goal is to find the people that already relate to me and put it out there. And if I can help smooth things over and open people's perspective, awesome. But that's actually not my job. My job is to be funny and put my thoughts and opinions out there. It's not for everybody. And if I do make it for everybody, it's watered down garbage. I don't want to be for 13-year-olds and 80-year-olds. I want to be for people that feel somewhat voiceless and feel somewhat invisible and feel somewhat confused and give them a place where they feel less alone.
I get that. While we're talking about the content of your comedy, I'm not going to ask you why you only talk about dating because that's ridiculous. But what I am going to ask you is, why is your set not 100% about your mom being a competitive power lifter?
I know, right?
That is the funniest thing ever. I want to hear an entire hour long special about that.
Well, what's really interesting is my mom has become kind of a character. And like, I have jokes about my mom killing cats. I have jokes about my mom talking about wanting to be cremated and then being planted as a flat. Like, my mom is incredibly funny and just a ridiculous character of a human and is very okay and open about me joking about stuff. I kind of always let her know once I created the joke. Same with my brother. I have a lot of jokes about my brother, Sammy. But they both are under the perspective of, if it's funny, it's fine. Like, my mom has even been like, you know, "I'll just pretend it's somebody else." I go, "Mom, we have the same face. Like, you're my only mom." It'd be one thing if I said a friend did this. There's a multitude of friends. There's no way of hiding. But I'm just so blown away by my mother. I'm blown away by both my parents. But like, my mom is such a badass human. I was just telling somebody the other day, because I do CrossFit, I was working with this girl and we were just talking about how we were having trouble benching and stuff like that. And I was just like, yeah, every time I have like a good day, it almost feels diminished because then I know how much my mom can lift. Like, my mom can lift 320 pounds and we're about the same size. Like, that's insane. And she had 5 kids and she's in her 60s. And like, I don't know. I think she's just such an impressive, incredible person.
Write more about that.
I will.
That whole thing just sounds right. All right. This is going to sound weird. Back in 2020, you had, I think it was a nationwide tour that was supposed to start February 1st. How'd that go?
I did a couple of the cities, which is interesting because I told my mom I was getting ready to go to Paris. That was going to be my first stop.
Holy shit. Paris, Texas?
Yeah, Paris, Texas. So I asked my mom, she was coming to visit me before I left for this tour. And I was like, you know, they're veterinarians. I was like, can you bring me a surgical mask? And she goes, that's so funny you asked me that. I was going to bring you a mask as a joke. And I was like, people are asking if I'm still going to Europe. I don't know. I assume it's just like the swine flu and it's going to blow over. But just in case it doesn't, I figured I should get a mask. So my mom brought me a mask and there was a shortage. There was already a shortage. And I went to France and I was one of three people wearing a mask on a plane. Do I feel like I really knew what I was doing? Absolutely not. But I was like, what's the harm in wearing a mask for 6 hours?
Well, nobody knew what they were doing. Absolutely nobody. So you're not alone there.
Yeah. But I, you know, my mom wears it during surgery. It clearly has some value. And what's the harm in wearing it? So I wore it. I should have probably also wore it on the subway, which I didn't. Also, looking back, by the way, I was really, really sick. One of the worst colds I've ever had in my life was 2 weeks before that. While I was touring, I almost lost my voice on stage. I was coughing so hard that I would wake up and I'm gasping for breath. Now, looking back, you know, they say that it was in New York City as early as December. So I'm assuming I had the original COVID right beforehand, which is even crazier because my mom came to visit me in New York City. I was still getting over my cold. You know, my mom ended up being fine or whatever. But like, you know, I'm pretty sure I traveled all over the country probably with COVID. Again, we didn't know. This was mid-February where it just really wasn't talked about. And then I went Paris. I went London. I even had a viral heckler video when I was in London where I mentioned giving an old man COVID or coronavirus because he wouldn't shut up. It was still kind of like not taken seriously. And then next thing you know, things are starting to shut down. It was mostly venues over 100 to 200. And I was feeling very fortunate that I was such a small comedian that it wasn't affecting me. And I was seeing if my shows in Switzerland and Germany were still going to happen. And then I went to bed and I woke up to 20 missed calls from like a really close friend of mine from high school. And she was like, I bought you a plane ticket home. Trump said, everybody needs to get out. They're not going to let you back in the country. So I just bought you a plane ticket. If you're mad at me, it's fine. And it turned out to be a lifesaver. Because everything immediately started to cancel. UK seemed fine when I was there. But next thing you know, we looked just like America. There's no toilet paper. There's no eggs. There's nothing on the shelves. She buys me this plane ticket. It was amazing. So like, I don't know if you remember, he said everybody like needs to come home. That first day, there was an 8-hour line at JFK to get through passport control. Wow. Then the next day, there was a 4-hour line to get through passport control. And then I was the third day. And it took 10 minutes. I brought snacks like I was hiking. I mean, I had trail mix. I had, you know what I mean? Like I had so much because I was like, okay, I'm going to make sure I have everything just in case I'm in this long line and, you know, I'm going to get work done and I don't care. Like, and it turned out to be 10 minutes.
Wow.
It was crazy.
Is that the same friend that you've been friends with since you were like a little kid?
So I have one friend that I've been friends with since I was 10 that I'm still close with. But my friend Amanda, I've been friends with since I was 14. She was at my first comedy show ever, like beyond encouraging. She bought me a How to Do Stand-Up book when I was 15.
Oh, sweet. Well, thanks, Amanda.
She's the best.
Hey, Streetwalkers. Here's a word from our sponsors.
Hi, I'm Erica.
And I'm Cassandra.
And we're the hosts of Trashy Trashy.
We're a podcast filled with trashy news stories and garbage people.
Did you leave the scene of an accident to go tanning?
Do you refer to wearing the strap down on your Crocs as sports mode?
Have you ordered Domino's online before they even open in the morning?
Are you switching the same AAA batteries from your TV remote to your vibrator instead of just buying more batteries?
Or are you normal?
Check us out wherever you download podcasts.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void. We're prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Let's get back into it.
These are just going to be weird, random questions. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you still think marriage is dumb?
I do.
Why?
let's just look at it exclusively from a woman's perspective. There is statistically almost no benefit for women. There's some tax breaks and hypothetically there's some support, but for the most part, women usually make more money if they don't get married. Women usually have stronger support systems when they don't get married. Most abuse and death happens because of their partner. Are there benefits if you get divorced and maybe you get alimony or child support or whatever? I don't know if that really, whatever. It is an institution that started to have women basically take care of men. And it hasn't changed that much. Do I know friends that have great marriages? Absolutely. Do women want to get married and have the wedding and have it all work out? Absolutely. And I encourage that and by all means do it. But I don't care about a wedding. I don't really care about marriage. I would like a partner. I would like somebody to show up, but I don't want to do anybody's laundry. And I want somebody to show up equally the same way I show up. And I feel like a lot of times marriage is a way for somebody, women, to do more of the work and take care of a dude as opposed to it being a mutual bond of taking care of each other.
That's fair. Are you still mad at TikTok?
Always. I'm always mad at TikTok. I'm in a perpetual mental fight with TikTok. It's dumb. I've had benefits from it, but I can't wait for it to die.
What did they censor you about?
They've censored me multiple times. The last thing they censored me for copyright infringement. I own all 4 of my hours and I had to write a letter to like a robot being like, you can't copyright infringe me because I tape this. I own this. This is mine. So what are we doing here? What's going on? And then a robot's like, we'll look into it. And you're like, are you looking into it, robot? Like you're just, I got censored for using the word sex. Why can't I use the word sex? What is social media? You can say sex on Jimmy Fallon. Why can't I say sex on TikTok? I got censored for a suicide joke. I've gotten censored for things that like are not explicitly dirty. If you look at the real boundaries, they're really explicitly said on YouTube. And that's what I really like about YouTube. The algorithm makes sense and there's a reason and rhyme and they explain everything super simply on YouTube that you can kind of understand. And TikTok is just erratic and stupid and I hate it.
Sweet. I've only gotten, well, I say one strike. I guess it's 2 strikes because I was so confused at why I got the first strike. I just reposted the same thing. So yeah. I got another strike. And all it was I interviewed Tommy Chong from Cheech and Chong.
Yeah.
So the entire post was just a clip of the audio, like a 30-second clip of the show, but then just a still photo of him with smoke coming out of his mouth. And they censored it for that. The picture. I was like, what are you talking about? You let kids eat Tide Pods on this thing.
Yeah, of course. But also, do you see the problem with it that you didn't explicitly understand why it got censored? So that's
I don't understand why.
Yeah. So not only do I not understand it, you don't understand it in the moment. And most of the censorship for YouTube is just you can't make money off it. So it's not even real censorship. It just means you can't monetize it. But it's all explicitly written out so you understand it. And TikTok makes me feel like I'm 10 again and I'm being reprimanded and I don't understand why. And there's no forward place to actually learn why. If you told me the exact rules, you can't say the word sex, you can't show smoke, you can't be holding a cigarette, whatever it is, whatever your rules are, I'll play by them, but write them out. Give me a way to understand them. I'm here making money for you. This is a free platform where I get almost nothing and you get all the benefits and you're still making it hard. What the fuck is the point? I know I'm yelling at you like you own TikTok.
No, that's okay. So you are still mad at TikTok forever.
Just a little bit.
Fuck them.
Just a little
bit. What is the difference between a good audience and a bad one? And how long does it take before you realize which one you're standing in front of?
It takes about a minute. But I do think you can convert a bad audience into a good audience. And the best feeling is converting a bad audience into a good audience. Does it feel good to kill? Absolutely. But what feels better is you earning that kill and being the one that made an audience a better audience or gaining an audience and nobody else seems to know how to gain them. So I wouldn't just say an audience is a bad audience and they can never get better. Some are just bad. They're bad. And you just have to accept it. Some of them are like, well, let's see what we can do here. But you can usually tell within a couple of minutes if an audience is good or not. How you deal with it and what you do to fix it is up to you, both your abilities and how much you want to work.
Do you think that historically speaking, that's why stand-up routines, for lack of a better term, build on how funny they are? Like your least funny stuff is at the beginning and then your most funny stuff is at the end. Do you think that's why it has morphed that way? Or am I even wrong that that's a thing?
No, no, you're not. So it's not your worst is in the beginning. I would say your second best joke is your opening joke and your best joke is your closing joke, especially if they don't know who you are. You have to build trust. So you can start a little bit slower if maybe you're famous because you've already built that trust with your career and your status. But if you do not have status, if you're going in cold and you're just a miscellaneous comedian, you have to get them. So that's going to be your second best joke. And then you're going to build up to your best joke. But it's not even just building up to your best joke. I would actually say it's building up to your most challenging joke. And the joke that's going to take the most understanding and belief in the comedian. If it's a 1-2 punch, you know, you get them right away and they like you and then they trust you. But some jokes are challenging in the sense that I need you to already trust me so that I can do something bigger. I might start out with a backflip, which is more impressive than a cartwheel and takes some skill, but I'm ending with a triple lux. Do you know what I'm saying? So like, it's like, you want to have enough to show that I'm skillage enough that you should be paying attention to me, but I'm not going to start with a triple lux because you don't even know how hard it is to do that and how much work. And I have to warm up and prove to you that what that was so impressive. So I think that's what it is building up a trust so that you can do exactly what you want and in a way that people understand and appreciate it.
Wow. That was a wonderful explanation and I appreciate every word of it.
Thanks.
I have a theory that cats are reincarnated people and that cats that are assholes are reincarnated from people who were assholes. Thoughts?
I don't think you're wrong. I would say this. I actually think cats are incredible. My cat's going through a phase right now. He is 6 months old. He's in his teenage phase. He's smoking pot. He is destroying things. He's lashing out. We're trying to work through it. But I think in general, cats respond to how you respond to them the same way that people respond to how you respond to them. So if a kid lashes out and you yell at them, would you get them to obey? Probably. But what they've learned is that love only comes when they do something right and that they have to be perfect to be loved. But if a kid lashes out and you show understanding and acceptance, not always easy, but you show understanding and acceptance, and then you teach them how to be better, they understand that whether they're good or bad, they can be loved. And I think the same is with cats. When they're cuddly, when they're sweet, when they're silly, when they're whatever, you give them love. But when they act out, if you're shitty to them, then they believe that that's a way to get attention. And if they're looking for attention, who really cares how they get it? So I think for me, I don't need my animals to be perfect. I don't need my friends to be perfect. I don't need my peers to be perfect. I just need them to be willing to show up and be loving when they can and also be willing to kind of learn. And I think cats are just as much willing to learn as dogs. It's just that they show up authentically and with flaws. And I don't think flaws make you a bad animal. I think flaws make you both an interesting person and an interesting animal.
Rad. I love that. I could say this one of two ways. I could say it two different ways. I'm going to do it both ways. What is lizard mail? What is Liz Road mail?
So lizard mail, which is just lizard without the A. I started kind of a small tech startup a couple of years ago. So I was headlining, but I was actually opening for my friend Hurry a lot too, just because he had a bigger, Hurry Kondabolu. He had a bigger fan base and he was doing big theaters and he's a good friend of mine. And so what I had noticed, and I was always very into mailing lists. I think it's important to have a mailing list. Social media is important, but social media dies. Vine has died. MySpace has died. Facebook is currently dying. And Instagram is in its later years. And hopefully TikTok will die because we know how I feel about TikTok. But things change, things morph, and you can build up this whole fan base on something. And then if it dies, you have nothing. So I've always had a mailing list, but mailing lists are really hard. So I used to put out these little cards on a table and ask people to sign up. And Hurry did the same thing. And then me and Hurry every Sunday would do like data entry. So I would literally put in your name and I put in your email and I put in your city. The problem is, especially with Hurry's fan base, because a lot of them were Indian, they would have these long Indian names and their emails would often be that. I didn't know if that was an A or an R. Now I'm looking up people's last name. I'm asking Hurry. I was like, have you ever heard the last name? Da-da-da-da. Like, you know, like genuinely being like, I want this email, because I was giving away my first album for $1 if you signed up. So I gave away my work, so I had access to tell you the next time I'm going to be in Chicago. And now I feel like I don't have access. So I was getting really frustrated. And I was even noticing that Hurry would have a clipboard a lot of the times and people weren't signing up. And so I started to think, if people are waiting in line for like almost 2 hours to take pictures and talk to Hurry after a show, what could they be doing in that line so that we capture their emails? And that's where I came up with this text startup, which is a way for audience to easily sign up for your mailing list via text so that they A, don't have to wait in line if they don't want to, but also we get an accurate email. I no longer have to do data entry, and it's a way for me to keep in touch with my fan base quicker and faster.
Rad. Oh my gosh. Check out you, all tech startup-y and stuff.
Yeah.
And so it is LAZRDMAIL. And what do I do?
Basically, you pick out what questions you want to ask your fan base. So like for me, all I want to know is your email and your zip code. So you would pick out what you're going to ask of people. You would write a little thank you message. You have like almost like a Twitter amount of space to write a thank you message. I always tell people to use the full URL. So if you want somebody to follow you on Instagram afterwards, or you want them to watch a YouTube video, you put the full URL and then pick out your code word. My code word is cats. And then you make cards or whatever. And so you'll see at show, like if you came to a live show, I'd have all those cards on the table. And at the end of my set, I would tell people how to sign up for my mailing list. You're going to text CATS to the phone number on this card, which is 206-207-5422. You're going to get a text that asks for your email. You get a text that asks for your zip code. And then you get a thank you message. I also let them know I'm never going to text them again. The next time I'm here, you'll get an email that's like, hey, I'm here. Come see me. And they'll be like, yeah. Or they'll be like, who? And you unsubscribe. It's a very loose commitment. It's just another way to stay in touch with people because, as you know, you post something on Instagram, people might not see it. You post something on Facebook, people might not see it. And I cannot tell you how many times somebody's like, when are you going to come to Houston? And I was like, dude, I was just there. I don't know your habits on these social medias. People miss it. The algorithm hides it from people. You will only get an email when I am within 75 miles of Houston. You will only get an email when I am within 75 miles of Boston, whatever your zip code is. It's been a game changer for me. I've quadrupled my fan base and lessened the amount of work I do. Like I said, to have someone's email and just to be able to give them information directly without playing this Instagram game has been a game changer.
I can't tell you how many times I have reached out to a band or a singer or a comedian and said, when are you coming to San Antonio? And they were like, fucking pay attention, bro. I was just there.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, I must have missed that Instagram, like you're saying.
Yeah.
I think that's genius. Well done.
Thank you.
Liz, as we're heading out, is there anything we didn't talk about or I didn't ask you that you wanted to talk about today? Did I miss anything? Oddly enough, we're going to hit your social medias in just a minute.
Yeah. Just that I have 4 hours out. 3 of them are on YouTube for free. And one of them is an album you can stream or buy. And really everything is at lizmealy.com, as well as my Why Cats Are Asshole book, which is, I'd like to believe, both for people that hate cats and for people that love cats, because those people have the same opinion.
Well, I think that is the perfect title to catch both people, because it's written by someone who adores cats. But the title makes somebody who doesn't like cats go, yeah, cats are assholes. I want to read that book.
Yeah, I've had a lot of cat haters buy it and put it on their coffee table. And I'm really kind of proud of that.
Nice. I love that. Maybe I'll buy it and I'll hit my cat with it. No, I won't.
Don't do that. We don't do abuse.
We don't do abuse.
What you do is you let them eat it. And I have had a lot of fans show me like the teeth marks in the book. And that makes me really proud.
That is super cute.
Yeah.
Last question. You're on a desert island. You can only have one. Is it Heathcliff, Garfield, or Tom from Tom and Jerry?
I'm going to say, I want to say Tom because he would catch me food. But now that I think of the cartoon, I don't know if he actually would. He would at least be entertaining.
Right. So we're going with Tom?
Yeah.
Love it. Liz, you told everybody already, everything that is social media is at Liz Mealy. Is there a LizMealy.com, did you say?
Yes.
And that's where we can find all the things in the book?
Yeah, everything's Liz Mealy.
And the 1 hour, the one that's not free, right? All that's LizMealy.com?
Yep, all of it. Yep.
Liz Mealy, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy day and your hectic cat joke writing schedule to hang out and let us get to know you a little bit better on Fascination Street. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
It was 100% my pleasure. And maybe the next time you come to San Antonio, I know you were just recently here. I missed it. But maybe the next time you come to San Antonio, I can come see you.
Join my mailing list.
Absolutely. Positively. And hit me with those. What do I got to text to where? I got to text cats to
206-207-5422.
Done. Just out of curiosity, the last time you were in San Antonio, did I understand correctly that you just rented out the whole place and sold the tickets yourself? Is that right?
Yeah, it's a really small venue. It's like 60 seats.
Which one was it?
Blind Tiger Comedy Club.
All right. Rock on.
Yeah.
Liz, have a great rest of your week. And I super appreciate your time.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm grateful.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Opening music is the song Magnolia from the 2001 album Intransigence, used with permission from Douglas Miles Clark. Closing music is from the song Say My Name off the 2021 album Underdog Anthems, used with permission from Jax Hollow. If you like the show, tell a friend, subscribe, and rate and review the show on iTunes and wherever else you download podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe to my YouTube channel. All the episodes are available there as well. Check me out on Vero at Fascination Street Pod and TikTok at Fascination Street Pod. And again, thanks for listening.